Welcome to The Point Home Services, the podcast where real contractors share real strategies. We cut through the noise and get straight to the point with the contractors that are working in the field right now. If you run a home services business and want to lead better, grow faster, and stay sharp, you're in the right place. Now, before we get started, I need you to do one thing. Only 30% of our listeners are following the show, so stop what you're doing, hit follow, and let's get to the point.
This is To The Point, a Rhino Experience, voted one of the top home services marketing and operations podcasts, cutting through the bullshit and getting to the point.
So, I already pulled out all the questions you guys don't want me to ask, but then I forget which ones, which sheet it was on. So this could be those, it could not be those, I don't remember. But I'm going to go ahead and go to the first one. This one's pretty easy. But I think it's an interesting one because it was came up quite a bit. And really, the first five set of questions I have came up more than four times each. So in one way, shape, or form. Pretty easy. This first one is simply, what motivated you guys to even want to grow such a large business?
What's that?
Take it.
Well, I think when I got started in business, you know, you don't know what you don't know. And I'm a very goal-oriented person. So I kept raising the bar for myself and my company. And every time I would get to a certain level, I'd say, well, if I did that, I can do this. If I did this, I can get to here. And then I got to a point where I was invited to be a part of a company called ARS back in the mid-90s, and I was a founding member, and we went out and we were going to roll up the business, the industry, much like what's going on today. And I got acquainted and got to work with some people who had some different experiences in scaling businesses, and that group came from BFI, the garbage consolidator, much like Waste Management. And so just watching and learning from them and understanding the methodology from it, it gave me some more confidence. And then I took that confidence, and my next business was bigger and more scaled. And then I sold that, and then I got to be around other people with other experiences. So I just think I'm a student of my experiences, and every time you get a little more confidence behind you, you're ready to take the next leap.
I'll tell you my case. Ever since I was 13 with my paper route and then working with my father driving trucks at 16, I always wanted to work. I've always worked six or seven days a week, and I always wanted to be a millionaire. I just didn't know how I was going to do it, but I knew if I kept on working, someday it'd work. So my brother asked me to come out to California and work with his plumbing company. But after catching two houses on fire, I decided I was better in the office than I was out in the field. But growing a large company, being this, I just never wanted to stop, and I still don't want to stop today. But the key thing in growing a company, don't think you're that smart. I constantly surrounded myself with very smart people, and everyone, just about every one of these guys.
Just about.
Yeah. At one time, was in a group that we were in. I was always in a group of six or seven. We'd have calls every Thursday. We share financials. And I always wanted to be the small guy, learning from the big guys what they did. And you just got to be humble. You've got to listen, and you got to learn, because you'll get down this line, you'll get six different answers, but they're all right. But one of them's going to fit your personality. And the last thing I'll say is, I think the key to my success, and I'm working on my third sale of the company, very successful because I've surrounded myself with good people, but more so the key thing is, you've got to hire people better than yourself. Don't think you're going to always be the best, because I've seen people are afraid to hire somebody better than themselves, and people will look down on them. This man right here, Frank DeMarco, is our CEO. you really should be here, not me. But he brought us, we were $50 million and before our first sale, and now we're over $100 million, over 20%, all because of this guy growing in 3 years of doing that. So you've got to have good people around you. Praise them. Treat them like family. You just got to be good to them. I mean, I think all of us, Ken, Jimmy, all these guys down here, Dave is a good, we're all good friends. We're all competitors. Certainly Odyssey, our group, is the best. But if you if he pisses you off, you would go one of these guys. So. But, you know, it's about being friends, and it's about working together and sharing. And, you know, I think most of you guys remember at some time we were in a group, and we share financials, and that helps you. If you could get a guy, Kevin Comer from up north, he and I were always the same, but I could see where my mistakes were. By looking at his financial mind, I could identify. And there's five things I can look at a financial and tell you exactly where the company's broken. But I learned that from these guys. So that's probably enough. Jimmy, you were the first killer out there, man. You were in our group.
Yeah, for me, it was a lot of people ask, you went from $7 million to $210 million in this 18-year span, and man, you must have had a master plan. You must have, you know, had it all figured out. And it was like, no, but I was just trying to make payroll when I bought it. So it was like, I never really worried about, I think Howard may have said, I never really worried about our competition at all. I kept my head down. I was competing against ourselves. We have enough problems to figure out and get better at. I don't need to worry about anybody else's problems. And so it was, if I'm nothing else, I am competitive. And it was that, you know, competitive spirit. I used to compete in sports, and now it's in business. And competing against guys like these is really an honor. So,
what was the question? No, just kidding. No, you know, it's interesting. I think you will get six different answers. For me, well, one, why not? Right, I mean, what's more fun than growing a business? It's just a ton of fun, right? It gets hard, but it's a lot of fun. People, the money doesn't suck. True. You know, I got in the space when I was 15 years old. People ask me, at 15 years old, did you think about doing this? And I have no idea. But I decided I wanted to be an entrepreneur, and I decided HVAC. But I thought the way in was technically. So back in the day when I went to high school, they offered trade schools, right? And they offered HVAC. So I figured that the way in was to learn the trade first. I'll figure everything else out. I'll be 61 next month, so you can do the math and how long I'm doing this. So, yeah, I know I'm old. But at the end of the day, you know, as I was growing my business in Atlanta, the bigger I got, the more people that got promoted, that came along, that did well. I never dreamed we'd be where we are today. I don't think any of us up here saw this 10, 15, 20 years ago. But one of the things I think I'm most proud of, as I think about some of the benefits of growing a business, what it means for others, and what I think I'm most proud of in what we're doing today is we've created, and what's happened and transpired in the industry over the last 3-4 years, and growth has allowed this to happen, is that we've created almost 100 new millionaires in our business. These are rank and file managers, service managers, county managers, CSRs, et cetera, who are doing the work day in, day out that have come on this journey, right? And all these guys, if you can say the same thing. And that's really cool to see people in your industry come along and become really wealthy. And for me, I think that's what I get the most out of, and being big helps that happen.
Let me say one thing, I'm sorry. I was going to say that, but you beat the hell out of it. I'm proud to say that I have six multimillionaires that 3 years ago was making $200,000 a year. Now they're multimillionaires, and they all are still working for the next deal, working harder than ever. But to have 100 like that, I'm just blown away. I'm very, very impressed. Good job.
I think for me, it came in different stages. Obviously, somebody else said it. It was just to survive initially. How do we make payroll? How do we grow the business? How do we create enough income coming in to provide the needs for my family? And then as we started getting some success and having really long-term employees with us, 10, 15, 20 years, they started looking at us, okay, where are we going with you, Jimmy? Where's our next step? So now today we promote most of all managers have come from within our company. They started off as technicians in the field. They advanced to now service managers. Then a lot of them have advanced to general managers running centers. So when we look at that, and you can't do that without growth. So if you're not growing your business, there are no management positions. There are no future positions for the people inside your company. So that's really where it's turned out for me is, you know, now it's the opportunity that we're able to provide for the employees inside the company. You know, if they want to relocate, we'll have a general manager position open up in some new center that we're opening up different places across the Southeast. So initially it was just, hey, how do I provide for my family? And then now it's how do we really provide an opportunity and a place to work for the employees that want to advance inside our company.
So I have a very similar story to all the stories up here, so I won't repeat it. But I would say as we get up to around 100 million in sales, you know, the thing that really drove me was creating that opportunities that you know, has been set up here. And also, I didn't want to get to the end of my career and say, well, I would have, I could have, I should have, and not try and not play full out. So really, my advice to you would be play full out, believe in yourself, and go faster.
Let me say one thing to this. Yes, sir. Let me say this to this whole, this question. It's like the guy who did the first 4-minute mile, right? And I don't remember the exact stats, but once he hit the 4-minute mile, then hundreds of people started hitting the 4-minute mile once he proved it could happen. So from my perspective, you know, Jimmy Hiller and I were in a group together, Airtime 500, and I heard about him and I heard the big numbers he was doing, and I'm thinking, if he can, I can. And then, you know, Patient Zero down here, Geiger, who sold the first big deal at over 100 million, I'm thinking, if he can, I can. And that's kind of fueled a lot of this growth. And you see, you just see it in the industry now. Used to be we'd all talk about our gross sales. Oh, we're a $25 million company, we're this or that. Now everyone's starting to get the clue and they're all starting talking about their EBITDA. So it's kind of, you know, once somebody breaks the mold, everybody else can go through and take it to the next level. I clearly see that the industry is going to play at a much higher level in this next few decades.
Perfect. I'm going to move on to the next question. What do you look for in a leader who is going to stay on and run an acquired company? How do you structure their compensation?
Say that again.
Sure. What do you look for in a leader who is going to stay on to run the acquired company? Let's start with that.
What's the second word? A leader or a meter?
Leader.
Okay.
So when acquiring a company, what do we look for in a leader?
Correct. So the company that you're acquiring, what are you looking for in a leader?
Well, obviously leadership skills. What's their bandwidth, right? You know, and how curious are they? Are they really interested in learning new things and taking to the next level? Are they a cultural fit? You know, things like that. And talking about getting to the next level, I think it's when I look around in this, I used to call it a roll-up space. Now they call it a build-up space, something like that. When I look at this new space, I think it's incumbent upon the build-up companies to really try to get the operators at least back up to a similar level of income that they were enjoying running the businesses, especially if they have high leadership capability and not just kind of play on stock options and things like that. The business has to attract talent and pay them accordingly.
Yeah, I would say the same thing. The only thing I look for, like, are they going to be fun to work with? Are you going to enjoy working with them? Do they laugh at your jokes? Can they make a joke where you laugh at? Having fun, as hard as we all work, having fun is an important part for me. So, and that's truth.
I'll go. I would say hungry, humble, and smart is what I'm looking for. And then as far as the pay, comes in three, you know, forms. One is salary. One is bonus in the short term for the year. And then tying somebody into the long-term value creation.
I had a switch. I'm the chairman of the board. I'm not the CEO. This man here can answer that better than I can.
I'm clearly not on the legends.
Brent, you should stand up. I know enough from.
You know, Dave said, I think, you know, look, it's just management leadership experience. Our comp structure is we expect our leaders to make very good money. They should be able to make money like an owner makes. So strong base salaries, be able to double it, more than double it. Options going into the deal. It's hard to find good leaders, but they got to be good to work with, got to have vision, got to be open, and, you know, just got to allow change. So I think it's been hit by a couple of people, so thanks.
Okay. You'll be up here next year instead of me.
I kind of look at it, can we go?
Yep.
I kind of look at it in four different things. First of all, you know, the businesses that we're acquiring is not at the same level that the PEs are doing, so ours are a little bit smaller. The first thing I look at is this individual coachable. So we call them the four C's. Number one is, are they coachable? Are they willing to listen to the direction we're going and follow in those directions? Number two is, are they committed? Are they really committed to what we're trying to do as a company and grow with us in that? Number three is, are they competent? They're competent in what they're doing each and every day. Can they really do the job that we're asking them to do? And then the fourth C is, do they care? Do they care about the people that they work with? Do they care about the company and willing to take care of it like we would? So that's what we look at.
Yeah, and I think it's been said, and Howard did a great job earlier, and leadership and culture has been talked about a lot over the last couple of days. So, you know, but maybe even to back up, I mean, for me and for us, it is, you know, the old saying, it's not the land, it's the man, and it's so true of having the right guy or gal in that spot. But, you know, first it's partnering with great companies and great markets with great cultures with great leaders and great management teams. With respect to the owner who's going to come along and remain a partner, obviously we want great leaders, and you know, obviously being empathetic, being a great listener, being respectful, a term that Kevin says a lot, you mentioned Comerford earlier, is, you know, being interested, not interesting. Think about that for a minute. It's not it being about you, but caring and listening to other people, making it about the other person, not yourself. And so, you know, just another trait I think is a big trait for a leader. So anyway, I think it's covered.
Okay. Next up is, what does your daily schedule look like? Hours worked weekly, whatever it is, but what does your daily schedule look like? I know what Leland's answer is going to be.
He sleeps all day.
I love working. I love the people I work with. I am a 7-day a work week, unless I'm down at the beach, but Saturdays and Sundays, the building I work in is empty. And I consider myself a looker. On the weekends, I look for anything, trying to find a problem that we can fix. I don't know what I'm going to find, but you'll know when you find it. You know, you read every job costing, you look at every invoice, you just look at everything. Just where can I improve this and make this better for everyone? But the successful guys that are going to be in the multimillionaire area are not two-day-a-week guys and vacation a lot or vacation during the summer. They're there all the time, and their people see you there. I have people call me on Sunday when they see my car out there and can't believe I'm working on Sunday. But I love it. It's not work. It's something I love and I've always loved. And that's me. Now, not everybody else works 7 days a week, but maybe I don't like to go home to the dogs, or I'm not sure. But I will tell you my one quick joke. I always go home every night to the two most beautiful blondes you can imagine. I hug on them, I kiss on them, then I say hi to my wife. I have two white golden retrievers, and I love those dogs. And they're at the door every night. Has nothing to do with that, but that's probably the only reason I go home.
Okay. You know, I've been getting up at 4:30 most of my life, so my day typically starts at 4:30, shower and get ready, and then sometime around 5:30 I start looking at reports, daily reports from the previous day to see what happened in each center that we have. And then, you know, I work, you know, 10, 12 hours most days of my life, depending on what my wife and my grandchildren. So I still, on weekends and nights that they have activities, you know, the work-family life balance, there's things that you'll never be able to get back. You know, when my granddaughter scores a basket and she looks over in the stands and sees that Pawpaw's still there watching her, those are things that you'll never get back. And then in the summer times, I spend a lot of time at the lake, so we typically go up there on Friday nights, and the most fun that I have in my life is pulling the grandchildren on the tube or on the wakeboard or whatever the case may be. So I work during the week 10 to 12 hours a day if necessary in the wintertime. I don't do that a whole lot in the summertime because I'm at the lake most of the summer on Saturdays and Sundays. But I work 10, 12 hours a day, you know, 5-6 days a week.
For me, nothing special. I'm pretty routine. I'm up every day around 5 when my afternoon. When my knees aren't bothering me, I'll be on the treadmill, try to get a run in before work, and then I'm old school. I don't like this remote stuff. I like being in the office. I like being able to walk down the hallway and talk to people, and so I'm typically in by 7:30, and I'm there all day. I don't go out for lunch. Work right through lunch, and just. That's pretty much it. Unfortunately, for all of us in this room, I suspect it's really hard to get away from work. And so whether you're at your desk or you're working remote, we got that phone that's attached to our ears most of the time. And so it's 7 days a week, 24/7, right? It is what it is. The phone rings, you answer it. And I've always been that way. So it doesn't change.
I'll go. So I'm probably 8 hours a day. I moved from CEO to chairman, but I still get pulled into a lot of different things. I would say I work differently than I did before. I know that PE they don't know what time it is, so they'll call you any time of the day or weekends, and I'm available for that. But for the most part, probably, you know, 40 to 50 hours a week.
So my last PE sponsor was Baum Capital Partners. The managing partner said to me one day, he said, there's not a corporation in America that would employ you the way that you work and the way that you handle your business. And that said, he said, but you're extremely effective at what you do. So I don't run a typical routine. I kind of roam around the earth and look for opportunities and work, focus on the vision of the company. Right now I have what I call Gettle Mondays, and I'm just on Zoom calls with touch base with my key people, right through the afternoon. And that's really about the contacts that I have with them. And then I'll be in the branches and look around, and I'm always digging for some new innovation that we can add to the company or a little twist to how we operate a process to make us more efficient and better. So I just kind of roam around and figure out what to do next.
I'm the same way. I work 50, 60 hours a week. I take the weekends off. You know, I'm not that good at golf, so I like working. That's how I compete in life. I think that'll change, and it has changed as I got two new grandkids, so spending more time with them. Things don't make me happy. People do. So, yep.
I think the majority of text messages I get from you guys are all 7 p.m., 8 p.m. They're never during day, like, work hours. Well, I guess those are your work hours. So, okay. This came up a few different times, and it's around some of the positions that you guys realized that you hired too late. So I guess this comes from as you were growing and learning or growing as the business, what are the positions that you know that you hired too late?
I hired them all too late, really. I wish I had more techs. I wish I had more people in the office.
I was gonna say, I think you hired them all right after you acquired them.
I'm known as a sandbagger in the wrench group. I'm never doing well, but until they get the P&L. The key position that I hired that really changed everything for Parker and Sons, we always grew by 7, 8, 9 million a year. We got in a good cadence with that, and I was able to hire a guy named Daryl Bingham, who came from George Brazil. He was George's right-hand guy. And when he came in the business, between he and I, and obviously a whole bunch of others, it enabled us to grow at even a faster pace. So all of a sudden, we were growing at 20 million, 30 million, last year at 40 million. And so when you get that person that kind of elevates your business, it kind of kicks things in gear, and you can run at a much faster pace.
So my best hire was in 96 when I hired who eventually became my partner, was Mark Aiken, and he had a different standard of where we could be, and it kind of really opened me up to where we could go. And as we progressed, we always hired every position to where we wanted to go, not where we were. And we would start with a CFO, and then a great sales manager named John Cameron, who unfortunately passed away. But always look forward to finding and hiring the best people. And Frank DeMarco was on that journey as well.
So I think the one that I regret not hiring earlier was chief people officer, or, you know, HR, an HR function. I mean, I built several businesses with never even having that function in our business until I really found somebody to take that role and understood what that role was. You know, back in my limited perspective, when I first started, the HR person was just the complaint department, and people would line out outside their door and complain every day, rather than this chief people officer that would help you develop your culture, develop your team, develop your people, develop your growth plans for your people, surrounding everything around the people, just like Howard said. So now, looking back on it, I think I would have really accelerated the company's growth had I looked at it that way.
I think for me, similarly to Paul Kelly, it was hiring a strong number two. And so, as my business grew and I got to about 60 million, I'm still running sales. So it allowed me to get a strong number two. I stole them from Parker and Sons. Before we came together, we go way back. So stole them from Parker and Sons, and allowed me to start working on the business instead of in the business, which is critical. And I can start you know, focusing on strategy and a little more strategic thinking and where we're going to take the business and where it's going. So if you don't have a strong number two, that frees your time up to work on the business versus in the business. I strongly urge you to do it now. Don't be afraid to spend the money. It's well worth the investment.
I don't think
I was that smart about this. That I was always believed that you grow the revenues, then you grow the people there, and that's where your profit is, which put a lot more work on myself and the people who are there. But when we did hire the right person, again, you hire somebody better than what you want that's going to grow into the next 10 or 20 million. But I was always delayed. I wanted the revenues first, then bring on the body to make sure that we were where we were. And again, I can't say enough that you always hire people better than you. You pay them well and treat them like family, and they'll grow with you. But then you got to realize, and they'll all probably agree with me, that a $10 million company who grows to 40 or 50, if your people don't grow with you, it's going to drag you back. You've got to realize you may have to let some go because they didn't grow with you. And you've got to have different people for that different level.
I think for me, Paul said it and Dave said it too. You know, I think I had 5 centers before I had a general manager in any of my centers. So that was obviously a mistake. I waited too long to hire most of them. When I started putting general managers in each one of the centers, you know, I always thought, well, I get it to this certain level by myself, and then I'll hire a general manager, and that was a mistake. And today we put a general manager in day one because I can't do it all anymore. From there to the district managers, to the CFO, to the human resources people, I waited too long on all of them. We do it better today when we see a need, or see, like what Dave said, where we're going and what we're going to need in the next year or two. We try to go ahead and hire for at that time.
One thing I'd add to that before is that as you grow, and as all of us have grown, there's positions you don't even know that you need and that's going to come up. And Frank has helped me so much on that, is identifying you need a person here for this because of that, because we've never been a $100 million company. It was never $50 million a couple of years ago. But as you grow, those positions come up and you realize you have to have it. And you just got to be aware of that. And that's where you, again, hang out with the people that are your size and larger, and you'll find out more and more and learn more. And you make a lot less mistakes when people have already gone through what you've gone through.
Hey, what's the thought on if you find the right person that comes along, but you don't necessarily have a position for them, but you know that they're a rock star? Is your take you hire them?
Yes.
I make room because I know Good. Somebody's going to go.
Perfect.
I'll give you an example. I hired Frank, and we were going to partner up. We had a deal, and I've never lost people that have been with me for 10 years. I had 4 people leave with the current general manager. And I made a decision not to do what we had planned, but fired him and brought Frank in. And then Frank became a partner in the deal. And it just, you've got to be, this is what you said, you've got a good person. You got to bring them in and keep them.
Yeah.
You'll find room for them. They'll be a revenue generator for you if it's treated right.
Yeah, so this came from a conversation like KG, you and I had probably a couple of years ago, because I learned that lesson from you where even in our own business, I noticed the right people were coming up who were expensive, who I thought were expensive. And I was like, I don't know where the hell I'm going to put this person, but I know they're the right fit. We're going to find a fit for them. So now 2 years later, I'm starting to see how those things are falling into place. So the risk was worth the reward because you had the right person taking all the stuff off of you. So I'm going to roll into this next question. This one's asked often. It says, what were your biggest growth roadblocks and how did you overcome them?
Yeah, for me, it's always been the people side of the business. You know, how can you attract, hire, develop, and retain the people that you need to help grow your business? everybody, at least I think up here, will say that there's plenty of business out there to be had. You just got to be able to bring the right people in at the right time to help you grow your business.
Yeah, and I would agree. I think it's about people. Really, the two barriers of the growth that I believe. One is first is sales and capacity. It's great. You know, if you make the phone ring, that's great. But you got to have the people to get the work done, and you got to have the right folks in the office running the business. So just making sure that you've got that team, you've got those folks in place, you've got enough capacity. And that's, you know, for me, again, owning the business in Atlanta, I always seemed a little behind in that. So that was probably the biggest challenge I had.
So I would agree with people, but I also would say my own stinking thinking, right? Why was I thinking bigger? Why wasn't I taking more chances? I think I could have grown faster. I look at the guys that are coming up now and what they're accomplishing, and I'm really excited for what's possible for the next generation.
I would also add one thing that I missed up on is the processes. I always thought, well, when I get to this next level, I'll put this process in place, and I should have done it long before I did.
So, you know, I'll parrot everything here, the people, and what Jimmy just said is the more people, more challenges, deeper processes you got to have in place, so they kind of go hand in hand. You got to understand how you build these teams, especially at a scale level.
Yeah, people again, but also the mindset. There's certain people in our industry, all of them up here on this panel, and most of you I know do the same. You get me thinking again. Even Ishmael, you know, as crazy as he may sound sometimes, I go to his location and he gets me thinking again. And if I start thinking, then I can figure things out. And so, you know, a roadblock is just sometimes yourself, you know, not thinking big enough or not thinking about the right things that'll make a difference.
So he doesn't get you thinking about retirement?
Okay, so I promise you this isn't my own question. Let me preface it with that. But thank you to the three others of you that wrote the same similar question, because I also would like to know, what other industries outside of home services are you guys interested in making involved in? Keep in mind, roofing is not technically home services, it's home improvement, but I digress.
Well, I've been making investments in the space, you know, all the ancillary services, some software, some technical stuff, some training things. You know, I'm just kind of staying in this orbit of this world that I've dedicated my whole career to. So those are the kind of businesses that I'm interested in over and above home service.
Maybe I can ask it a little bit different way to whether you're interested in it yourself personally or not, but what is interesting or what are you seeing out there that might look like another successful channel to get into?
Yeah, I mean, anything with technology, and not that I'm a technical person, but I get enamored with seeing how things can change an industry. So whether it's Nuve or whether it's something else, I think those are the kind of things that I get excited about looking into and investing in. So.
Yeah, I guess for me, the only thing that interests me that's pretty safe bet in today's world is real estate. So we do have a little bit of investment into real estate. But I've always thought the best bet is always betting on myself and what we can do and what we can control. So.
Yeah, for us, you know, the HVAC, plumbing, and electrical space residentially is about $130 billion across the U.S., and our sales aren't anywhere near that. So we're going to focus on things that we know. Not quite. We're going to focus on things that we know how to do. And until we have all of our locations doing all three trades, which we're getting close, you know, and then growing those three trades for us, we're going to stick to what we know and do well. There's some adjacent things, right, that you can do in related markets we can serve. But there's so much opportunity in those three. I don't see the reason to branch out on roofing or take Tommy's business away with garage doors, but you never know. Watch out. But yeah, so it's just ton of opportunity.
So I'm heavily invested in HVAC, but also I've invested in home improvement and roofing, windows, and one-day baths. So I like the home improvement business. I think it translates really well. The big tickets, you know, marketing's a little cheaper, I think. And I like this. I like the business.
Yeah, I'm very similar to Dave. I believe in doing what you do well. And I don't have any interest in trying to be anything other than HVAC plumbing company, because I believe you start with what you know well and get it perfect. We after 22 years, we just added plumbing, and but we were 25% bottom line HVAC, and we were growing. And we hit plumbing to our club members and just 15 million of that within a year or two. But I always discourage people, don't add plumbing or don't add HVAC or don't add electrical until you get the other ones down perfect that you really got. Because actually we bought a company that they didn't have any of it down, so they just kept on adding different trades that they did bad at. They weren't making the money. They weren't doing it right. So they thought, well, let's do another trade. Get your one trade down, get it perfect, then add another trade. So in my case, I have no desire ever to get out of some type of home services. I would add electrical at some point once we think we got the plumbing. And because if you distract your key people, your key managers, they're working on your HVAC and plumbing, and you throw them into electrical, you hurt the other trades. So you just want to make sure you make the money, and you can make a lot of money in those two, then add the third one, but you got to get the right people. But no, I have no interest in outside of what I know.
You know, and when you look on the internet, the greatest business that gets promoted every single day is internet marketing. We all should probably get in the internet marketing business. These guys are making ton of cash.
Hey, it's not a bad place to be, and for the low, low price. Dave, thanks for holding down on roofing. I appreciate you. We're having a good time with it. That's a good business. This is a pretty cool question. I know Goodrich, you and I have had some conversations around this. Leland and I have had conversations around this. Doesn't really pertain to business directly, but any of us who are in business for ourselves have some sort of sacrifice with our families, right? Like, when you're growing your business, you have to have balance, and a lot of times there isn't balance. But if you could go back in time, what would you do things differently in this phase of growing the business, but personally? Think about what you sacrificed and things that you had given up, if it's anything, but what would you have done differently personally as you were growing your business? Personally at home, like not business related, you were growing the business, but how did it impact you personally? Was there anything negative in that? And like, what would you go back and change?
Well, I think for me, when I first started, you know, one of the challenges when you come out of a service truck into the trades, you really don't have the education that you need to run a business. And you know, you've heard my story of the struggle. But really the struggle was my lack of understanding that I needed to go get the education first. And so I wish I would have gotten a little more education and be able to manage my life, my family life, a little better, whereby I wasn't so consumed with figuring out this great puzzle on how to run a business. And I could, you know, devote my 12 hours a day at that, but really segment more time for the family. I believe that I was able to get a lot of good time with the family and took the vacations and went to the Little League games and I did all that stuff well. But now looking back on it, I don't think it was worth it. So I think I would rather spent some more time focusing on getting the education I need so I didn't just completely consume myself with learning how to run the business.
So when you're growing the business, you're working, you're running as hard as you can to do what you have to do. And later on, you look back and you say, I should have spent more time with the family and the kids. Although, like Ken said, I was at all the games and all. But my advice would be put fences around your time. And when you're with your family, be with your family. And when you're at work, be at work. Because at the end of the day, you can't get that time back.
Yeah, I have a similar story where in my early career, I traveled a lot, so I wasn't home enough. Luckily, my wife is a great mother, and we ended up with two great kids. And we ended up in the business together, where Josh worked at Parker & Sons, and then started Clover, and now Justine and my wife work in the business, and I always tell my wife as we're driving to work, I said, I love coming to work with you. We go to work and leave work together. And she goes, oh, you just like using the carpool lane. And I said, yeah, you're right. But a lesson I learned a long time ago, you hear a lot of parents say, you know, I don't have a lot of time with my kids, but the time I do spend is quality time. And I learned this from Spencer Lee, an old mentor of mine at Roto-Rooter. He said, that's bullshit. He said, go for quantity. There's no such thing as quality. 5 hours in front of the TV is way better than any 1 hour, you know, at the zoo or whatever. And so quantity is a big thing now.
Yeah, so Paul and I came from that same company and traveled a lot. So for you know, when you're traveling 3 weeks out of the month, it's not great for the relationship. And so I'm married to my second wife now for 10 years, and certainly she's terrific. But you know, when you're traveling and spending that much time away, it's tough. And my kids were in the early years and growing up, so I missed quite a bit. And you know, looking back, you know, I regret that for sure. So I think the advice is, you know, someone said, put fences around it, and with your family, be there. You know, leave the phone at home. I know we all get yelled at for when you're out to dinner and the phone rings and it's work and you take it and you get to look. But, you know, leave the phone in your pocket and pick up the call later. So, and that's critical. And so even in this role now, I do not travel anywhere near the amount I did, you know, back in the 90s and early 2000s. And I just won't. I get out when I need to, but I make sure that I'm home.
Your second wife, I introduced my wife one time as, this is Sean, my first wife. She saw no humor in that. She still is 40 years later, my first wife. I don't do that anymore, but long story short, I wouldn't change anything. I have three children. My youngest son is 6'7". I never missed a basketball game ever. Even on traveling, I would go, but if I was home, I was at work. If he was traveling to Vegas or whatever for a couple of days, he'd have a friggin' game at 8 in the morning, 11 o'clock at night, but I was there. And one Father's Day, my wife asked the kids, what do you remember about your dad the most? And my son said that dad was at every game I played. And that meant the world to me that he knew. And he always wanted to work for me. He told me later on that when he got out of college, he wanted to work, and he's worked for me for 11, 12 years now. And my daughters all worked. I had a daughter that worked from her home recruiting, had another daughter that worked in the office, but they've all moved on at this point, but they did it kind of out of college. But I wouldn't change it. I mean, if I had it in an event, the kids' events, when they were little, when they're older, and now with 8 grandchildren, that might change a little bit, but I was always with them, and that was more important. But on the other side, if I wasn't, I was at work. And if something bad was going on at work, the kids would understand that maybe I might miss dinner that night or whatever, but you've got to have, just as everybody here has said, family is important. It's probably more important than anything because you're working for your family. And I'm on my third deal now, and I tell Frank constantly, I am now working for my grandchildren, for their life and for their livelihood, because I've got plenty. I want more for them, and I'm not being greedy, but I want them to have a great life and not have to struggle through things. So it's all about family, man. All about family, no matter what it is.
I think that, you know, parents every single day have to make a difficult decision. Do I go to work to provide better for my family, or do I stay home and spend time with them? And depending on which decision you make has consequences on both sides of it. Yeah. If you stay home and spend more time with them, then you may be sacrificing some of the income and things that you want to provide for them. If you choose to go to work, then you sacrifice the time that you get to spend with them. So it's a very difficult decision that you have to make every single day of your life, and it's obviously your choice on what you want to do. But, you know, I think, just like a mixture of everybody on the stage today, you know, I worked too much early on. I was in business for 17 years before I ever took my first vacation. And, you know, my children bring that up from time to time. And now we're able to do pretty much whatever we want to whenever we want to, yeah, and take vacations. I think one of the best lessons that parents have to instill in their children is how to work. Right? Everybody has to go to work in some way to provide for their parents, so, or for their children and for themselves. So, you know, I think, and I'm very proud to say that all, at least three of my children, my youngest one's sophomore in college, so I think she'll learn the same things, because they watch me do it every day. They watch me get up at 4:30 every morning and go to work to provide for them. So I wouldn't change a whole lot. I would take more time off for vacations with my family. But other than that, they've all turned out pretty well.
Great. I will say one thing. When at a smaller size, 10 million and less, I would bring them to work with me. And my 6'7" son at that time was 7 or 8 years old, was taller than our bookkeeper. But they would play, and they could come in and play in the room. Now that they're older, I bring the dogs in on the weekend, not during the time, but I did bring them in, and they were just part of it. And yeah.
Well, one, I know how much like the value of time is, and so thank all of you for coming here and being with us and making the time to get here and enjoying the freezing cold temperatures in Phoenix, Arizona. I'm grateful for that. You guys all know.
I'll pay for the inside dining next time.
Wasn't
just let
that?
Me know.
I promise it wasn't that.
I'm going to start raising our prices and we're going to have a great dinner.
Okay. You heard it, Frank.
You heard Frank heard it.
All right, we're getting close. We've got about 11 minutes or so left. I'm going to switch gears back to a private equity question. This one is, how do you see interest rates affecting the pace and value of HVAC consolidation?
I mean, look, we have, you know, everybody experiences this with our private equity partner. I mean, it seems pretty simple. The rates go up, multiples flatten or go down. I mean, it's a relationship that happens. It's harder to borrow money, even though most of these firms have plenty of cash to put in. But then when they do that, shareholders get diluted. It's tricky. So, you know, what we're seeing is we're still tenacious, like everybody up here, trying to get deals done, but it's harder. It's harder and it's going to stay harder because money is expensive. And until that flattens or goes the other way, I mean, the conversations we're having today is, felt like in 21 and probably most of 22 was just, there's another higher multiple you have to pay for a business. And it seems quieter, I'd say maybe amongst my peers, where they're just not going to continue to go up and up and up. In fact, they're flattening and you're starting to see them go down, or people walk away from deals because that math doesn't make sense. And it's simple economics. They have to go get the money, and that money's expensive. We all borrow to do this, and I can assure you we're paying more on our interest. Like, we pay more interest. There was no question. You're paying more on the money you borrowed. And that's just the reality. So that relationship seems very relative. Rates are going up, multiples are flattening or going down. But that's been my experience over the last, you know, this recent past.
Yeah, I think Frank is spot on. We're definitely seeing some slowdown. I mean, the cost of capital, as Frank says, has gone up quite a bit. It's more than doubled what it was just 3 years ago. However, there is a lot of money out there, and I think and there's lots of money floating around that are burning holes in pockets, and they've got to put that money to use. PE does. However, that said, I mean, I think speaking for myself, we're being a little more cautious, a little more strategic, a little more careful who we partner with to make sure that more than ever. We've always been strategic and careful as to who we partner with, but I think we're even more so today, making sure that we feel really good that we're partnering with the right team, the right leader, the right company, right market, et cetera. But the pace in which deals have been getting done has slowed down. There's still deals getting done, but I think it's going to be slower over the next. If you haven't, first, a lot of the real the big players have been taken off the market, right? There's still a few left, Jimmy being one of them. But there's a handful. What's beautiful about this space is, you know, while the industry is about $130 billion, private equity, as much private equity as in the space, they own less than 10% of it. This space will always be largely dominated by, excuse the term, mom and pops. And it's just the way it's going to be. I mean, regardless of how many deals are done, you know, think about this, for every company that joins private equity or sells, there's 25 in a market, there's 25 new ones that day, that startup. 25 in a market for everyone that sells in that market. It's so fragmented, the space is so big that it's just going to be dominated. So all the smaller plays right now are, you know, they're getting smarter. They're building their businesses. If you haven't been acquired by now, not that you can't get a deal done, you certainly can. You may wait. You may have to wait for the next couple of years to get what you really think your business is worth or want for it. Just my two cents.
Well, we know that you know, interest rates are going to cause slowdown on things. The arbitrage players, you know, the guys who are just rounding up as much many companies and revenue and alleged EBITDA as much as they can, and they're flipping these businesses, they're the ones who are going to get tied down first. They're the ones who are not going to be able to pay and maybe not even able to support the debt that they do have. So I see that coming. So at this stage, if you're not in the game yet, you kind of want to look for a sponsor that's more of a strategic sponsor, an operating sponsor who doesn't lever up so much. They're not so highly dependent on the leverage. They got a lot of capital. They got to deploy it. They got to work. But really, they're not going to try to make their gains on an arbitrage. They're trying to make it on growth and, you know, growing the base business, improving the base business, and earning it from that place as opposed to a flip.
So I don't have anything really to add other than, you know, as this process goes forward, growth is going to be more and more important to get to the number you want to get to. So focus on your business, focus on the growth, and strategic buyer will be there when you're ready.
What they all said.
Well, I'm not in the space, so I don't have any comment on it.
Man, a few words, PK. Vanilla. Okay, our last question, because I know how this is going to go in the next 5 minutes, is Tommy. Tommy, you're going to ask the last question. Make it a good one.
It will be.
Don't mess it up.
All right. So you guys, a lot of you guys have grown through acquisitions. I think our goal is to grow 40% organically and by $15 million of EBITDA a year. And I'm realizing a lot of people in here think, just go buy more companies. It's easy. And I've realized how hard an integration is. You're taking over a new culture. You're combining two teams. It could be rather difficult, especially if we're talking CRMs. And there's a lot to do with the way the chart of accounts work and the pay structures. And there's a lot of mistakes that can happen. It's not simple to purchase a company. And I would just want to know, a lot of us would probably want to know, is if you guys made a mistake or what's great advice, one or two things each of you would say of when you're going to do an integration, this is something you want to be very careful about, or this is the best thing I've learned from making a grave mistake.
I can talk to that. I'll let Ken kind of talk from the wrench perspective. At Parker & Sons, we grew. It was all organic, so there weren't any acquisitions. But I believe what Tommy said wholeheartedly, to integrate two companies together is a tough gig. Two companies in a market operating independently, much, much easier. So anytime you're thinking about integrating a company into yours or them into you, it takes a lot of planning. And sometimes you think 1 + 1 is going to equal 3 or 4. Sometimes 1 + 1 equals 1.2 or 0.75. So you got to be really, really careful.
I think what I'm really most keyed into lately is, you know, you're looking at some of these businesses that have a business model. Maybe it came from a best practice group, a Nextstar, a success groups, a EGIA or something. They're using a fundamental model. And it's very difficult to get that team off that model if you don't deploy it, or it doesn't match how you want to think about it, or it doesn't match just the general vernacular inside your business. And so you got to be very, very careful when you buy these businesses that have really strong processes that usually came from a best practice group. And if you're not in that same mode, you can tear apart a business very quickly that way. So make sure that you understand what model they're using and have a complete plan on how you will migrate that plan closer to what you want it to be, and or just leave it alone.
Yeah, organic growth trumps anything else out there. My advice is continue to focus on growth. For us, acquisition, we've done a fair amount of acquisitions, don't get me wrong, but it's been very strategic, and it's always been icing on the cake. I get zero pressure from our PE partners. They would love for us to do deals. They want to grow. But, you know, with the exception of Vish, we're very, very careful who we partner with. Just kidding, Ish, we love you. But seriously, I, if you want to create value in your business, value creation will come from organic growth. Focus on organic growth, maybe do some greenfields, and use acquisitions as icing on the cake. When you find the right business that you absolutely, we use a term called an asset. But if you find the right asset and you got to own it, stretch and go get it done. If it's that important, if it's a new geography, a new hill you want to own and be at, stretch for it. But outside of that, it's really about organic growth. And to Paul's point, and Tom, your question on integration, it's really hard to put and bring two cultures together. If anyone in this room has ever done that, not that it can't be done, but it's got to be really, really, really well thought out. Especially if they're similar industries, a little bit easier to do an HVAC and plumbing versus a HVAC and HVAC culture, I have found. But nonetheless, it's still difficult. And I would be really careful if you're going to go down that road, how you do it.
I agree with everything that's been said. The one deal that I had go bad was because I we got too involved in the deal, and the integrity of the former owner was not good. And so the lesson I learned is walk if it smells a little bit, it'll probably smell a lot after you close, and walk away from it.
I agree with everything that has been really said, especially from what Ken said. You've got to be selective, and I know that Frank has probably said no to companies more than he said yes to companies because of the culture and the fit. And it's not as easy as you might think. Any hour I can ask you, you're new, I think you're pretty new into this. It's not easy. It's not an easy thing that people just can pick up. So, but in conclusion, just for me, I'd like to say all these guys up here, you've got George, I mean, you've got Any Hour, you've got Lawrence, you've got certain people in here that are doing this. They all are very good at what they do. They're all very respectful. I've known these guys forever. I think Mr. Goodrich was one of the first ones because I grew this beard for him today. But, I mean, we all like each other. I mean, there's no animosity. There's no hatred. It's we're all friends. We all talk. We're competitors, but we're respectful. And that's very unique in this room. There's probably some groups out there. I think when I sold 3.5 years ago, there was 3 people, I think, out there. There's probably 30 or 40, who knows how many people are out there looking. So if you're looking to sell your company and reinvest, my best advice to you is I would say what I did. I'm sorry.
Join the wrench group?
Wrench group. I would have, but I didn't know who you were. Yeah, I did. But is that reinvest. If you sell, reinvest. I reinvested in 18 months. I bonused some of our people out, and they became multimillionaires in 18 months because we sold again. Then I reinvested again. Now we're in our third sale. We're probably going to have this happen another year, a half or two. So don't forget the reinvestment part, because I'm probably going to get 3 times what I thought I would get up front to the right people. But more so, money isn't everything. How are you going to be treated? How are your people going to be treated? Look at those and see what they've done. Talk to the people. And I can tell you, every one of these guys up here, for sure, I know I would sell to them if I was doing it again, because I respect them, I know them well, and they're just good, good people. If you ever want to have a question or talk about something, I was telling some gentleman last night, I'll tell you everything that you might miss, even if you sell to somebody else. And these guys would be the same way. They want you successful. They want you, if they buy you, they want you happy as hell. They're not looking to destroy you or hurt you in any way. So you've got a great group here, and you've got 3 or 4 of you guys are just as good out there. But I would say for me, my best decision I made was a hard myself, but better when I hired this gentleman here, Frank DeMarco, who came from a great friend, Dave Geiger, down there. I've known him for 7 or 8 years, and he was in one of the groups, and I always saw Dave. And when Frank moved out, he referred him to me, and it was the best, because I couldn't run 20 companies. I don't know anybody who could run 20 companies, but he certainly found the people, he ran it and did a good job. And these guys are all just as well, especially this guy here. You were the first, right? Yeah. And so I'm just trying to compliment the people that are in this room. Chris brought in great people. If you don't have a good marketing team, you're an idiot if you don't use this guy. This guy is unbelievable. He's got an unbelievable team.
Thank you. That was a pretty good interview.
Always have been so impressed from the first day I met him. It's just, he's a gentleman, and they're good at what they do. So
I appreciate that. Thanks, Leland.
Sure. Let me just say one last thing on the acquisition thing. This happened to me the other day. So I meet this PE guy. He's all excited about the space. He bought a bunch of businesses. I go, what's your plan? Because they were like, you know, one in California, one in Kentucky, and then up, you know, I don't even know the eastern part of the country, you know, Pennsylvania or something. And I'm like, well, what's your plan? He goes, buy them for 10, sell them for 20. And I go, well, you still got to run the fuckers. I mean, like, you know, that's where people keep making this mistake. It's not a foregone conclusion that you buy $2 million in EBITDA and it's going to stay at $2 million in EBITDA or grow. You have to lead those businesses and grow them. You know, Leland and I were at ARS in the 90s when it hit $1 billion in revenue. And then it went to $350 million in revenue. And I don't think they're still, I don't think they're at $1 billion today.
They are. Yeah, they are. They're at $1 billion.
They're just right at $1 billion?
Well, maybe a little more.
So think about how long it took them to recover. 99, they bought $1 billion in revenue, and it took them this long.
But I think what's really interesting, it's kind of sad. If you look at that business, I mean, ARS has been around for a long time. They ought to be at $2-3 billion. So they sold the business a few years ago, and I forget who they're with now. But for a business that was almost $1 billion, in a space at the time that's getting 15, 17, 18 times EBITDA, they got 10. So it told you that they didn't run the business. I mean, they made a lot of mistakes. One customer represented 40% of their revenue, right? I mean, who that is, and didn't have the right strategy, and they got penalized for it, and they got hit pretty hard. So, yeah, to Ken's point, there's no guarantees. You got to run a business, and you can't be a federation. You know, we can talk all day around integration and centralization and what that looks like, what you should do, what you shouldn't do, what's the right answer. And there's no one right answer. There's different ways to skin the cat. They didn't do a lot of things right, and they're trying to fix that.
I would say when Jim and I were there, I don't know what happened afterwards, but the CEO was a
Well, gentlemen, thank you. I think we should all stand up and give these guys a big round of applause. Listeners, thank you so much again for listening to this podcast week after week. We are extremely grateful. Again, the whole purpose of this podcast is to give back to the home services industry that we love so much, whether you're a rhino or not. We really, really appreciate all the subscribers. And if you haven't subscribed yet, please go in and subscribe and you'll get all the episodes sent to you automatically weekly. Also, we have really enjoyed your feedback. It's so meaningful for us when we get to read the nice comments that you guys put. So keep doing that. And if you don't know how to do it, here's what you got to do. You search for To The Point Home Services on Apple Podcasts. You click on our profile, scroll all the way down to the bottom and hit write a review. And be honest and share your story and how the podcast has impacted you and your business. Thanks again from the bottom of our hearts at To The Point Home Services Podcast. We appreciate you. Welcome to The Point Home Services, the podcast where real contractors share real strategies. We cut through the noise and get straight to the point with the contractors that are working in the field right now. If you run a home services business and want to lead better, grow faster, and stay sharp, you're in the right place. Now, before we get started, I need you to do one thing. Only 30% of our listeners are following the show. So stop what you're doing, hit follow, and let's get to the point.